Psalm 45, along with being a psalm of the sons of Korah, is also called a love song. It's a song about the beauty of the king. Now, it's kind of weird for us because we live in a hyper-sexualized age where we can't really conceive of a man whose job it is to write songs for church, writing a song about the king in which he is not himself sexually attracted to the king. It doesn't jive with the way we have come to view sexuality, but it is perfectly capable of being done in the ancient world. Jonathan and David could hold hands without it ever being sexual. And, you know, I know this is the case in part from experience. I once took a trip to visit and work with a group that fed the poor in the camps that grew up around the dump of Guatemala City. People who made their living digging through the trash to find things to sell, which they could then use to feed their families. In any case, some of the younger children who had grown up in and around that mission now worked with that mission. And the young men in their late teens, early 20s, and they'd come up to you and they'd stand beside you, mano y mano, and they'd put their arm around you and you'd be body to body, right? We're sitting on a car and he's got his arm around me. And it's like, it's at that moment I realized I live in an age that is a culture that is messed up, because there's nothing wrong with what he's doing. What's wrong is how I can't conceive of it in any other way. And this is really what the sexual revolution has done for us. In any case, healthier cultures have no problem acknowledging the beauty of something or somebody without it having to be about power, money, and sex. And so here's a song to the king and to the queen. And it's all about the throne of God, right? Verse 6, God's throne is forever and ever. The scepter of his kingdom is the scepter of uprightness, the throne that's been established by God for David. And this way, this is really about Jesus, is one that is for the good of mankind, that shall never pass away. And in this, true righteousness has been given to mankind, which means with it a hatred of wickedness. For you and me, of course, this is a saint-sinner war within reality. But Jesus, the prince, the king, who we must kiss his feet, lest he be angry with us and we perish in the way, as Psalm 2 opens the Psalter. This king is good. And his love of righteousness is for the goodness of creation. And his hatred of wickedness is because wickedness causes harm. The only problem is because we stand in the seat of wickedness, we're now over and against him, right? We're enemies, or we were, until we were blood-bought by the sacrifice of this king, this Christ. And this is the beauty of his throne that endures forever. And therefore, God, your God, has anointed you. That's christened you, Christed you, Messiahed you. Now, you could read this as two ways. God, who is your God, has anointed you. Or you, God, have had your God anoint you. And that sounds weird, but I think that's the one that's right, because that's the way Jesus speaks. Jesus calls the Father his God and our God, even though he is one with the Father, right? Co-equal in majesty, but distinct, especially with reference to his humanity. It's the mystery of the triune divinity. You don't try to wrap your head around it, but enjoy this fact that you have one God who is two persons, both of whom have sworn with an oath that the work the second person has done has been for your benefit. The Christing of him with the oil of gladness beyond his companions is the crucifixion of his body on the cross that was to be the source of the joy, the source of the comfort that he would earn for you. So that the robes of him are fragrant with myrrh. That's something he used to bury somebody, by the way. And aloe and cassia. Here, in this case, is a party. It's a celebration. But see, there's a both and going on. And don't miss how his robe is the thing that we need most. His body, his cleanness, is the thing that you need most. So that there is, again, this image of utter giving and utter wealth. Ivory palaces with stringed instruments playing fine music. Daughters of kings among the ladies of honor. And at the right hand, the queen in gold of Ophir. Now, queen, that's the church. That's truly you and I. That is, we who are the bride of Christ, again, blood-bought by our husband, who has cleansed us with a washing of water and the word, that we might be presented before him holy and without spot or blemish, that we might sit beside him clean in the white wedding dress robe of his righteousness for us. So the psalmist then turns and sings to the daughter of Zion, who's also us, right? We who would believe, we who see this and hope in this. Hear, O daughter, consider, incline your ear, forget your people, your father's house, because the king has desired your beauty. Now think here of Ruth. Ruth married to a Hebrew who didn't really, from what the text seems to say, believe very much. He dies, stuck with the mom who kind of believes, I'm going to go back to my God, but you stay here with your foreign gods. They'll treat you better than my gods treated me. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Where's the missionary gospel in that, lady? Come on, Naomi, you can do better. And Ruth says, no, no, no. Death will not part me from you. For I will have your God be my God now. As Ruth, through all of that, had come to believe in Yahweh. Forget your people and your father's house. She left them all behind and went to the place where the Ark of the Covenant was, where salvation is. And this is the case then for you and I, right? Christ has come to set a sword on the earth to divide even fathers and sons, even mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. He divides because he's pulling you as a brand plucked from the fire out from the midst of this veil of destruction. And those who do not believe it or will not believe it, they cannot fathom it because you have become comfortable with the smell of your own death and they're spending their entire lives trying to hide from it. You've become comfortable with the aroma of the future and they keep trying to make the future now. You are comfortable because the king has desired you and the beauty which you did not have has now been made sure and certain as a promise. I absolve you from all of your sins. He is your Lord. Bow to him. The people of Tyre will seek you with favor and gifts, the richest of all people. All glorious is the princess in her chamber, with robes interwoven with gold. Many colored robes led to the king, along with virgin companions behind her. That's the day of resurrection. You got Joseph's dream coat. You got Isaiah's fresh, clean robe, Zechariah's headdress. You got the wedding feast and the free invitation and the wedding garment given to all who would join, which is not those who should join, because those who ought to join can't. But the beggars and the losers from the highways and the byways of life, those who have no business being there, they are approached by a messenger who takes a glorious garment and covers them with it. And says, come, come, the feast is prepared, come. Buy milk without price. All ye who are weary and heavy laden, look, here is rest. It's a love song. It's the Song of Solomon writ small. It's the promise that marriage has always been for us. A image, a picture of the fidelity, the steadfast commitment, the unbreakable unity that God Almighty has chosen to promise you in the flesh and blood of your husband, Jesus Christ. Of our husband, Jesus Christ. Don't go hypersexual on the language. That's the culture. Don't do that. It's about unity and fidelity and unbreakableness and steadfastness. That's the kind of commitment your God has in Jesus for you. The wisdom of Solomon, which joins our meditatio, our meditation this morning, is from Proverbs chapter 14, verse 6. A scoffer seeks wisdom in vain. But knowledge is easy for a man of understanding. Remember, the scoffer is the low of the low. He is the truly wicked one. He doesn't merely not believe or question belief. He thinks it's funny to not believe. He laughs. He scoffs at God. Now, according to the proverb here, that scoffer could be also someone who thinks real learning is funny in general. If we're just going to talk at that horizontal level, that basic, even secular level of the proverb. So if you can follow this, trying to understand something or learn something, to find wisdom, to find common sense, to improve your mind, while also thinking the whole thing's a game, or that it doesn't really matter what you do, or that you've already got it, well, that's all vanity, right? So in a sense, you could just say the fool seeks wisdom in vain. Well, how do you make a fool wise? You can't, because by definition, he doesn't want to be. A fool would not become wise. A man would stop being a fool and become a wise man. And maybe that's too narrow a distinction, but I think it's important to understand. You can't find wisdom in a foolish way. It's the other way around. It's like a sick man being healed, right? You don't heal by getting the sickness better. The body gets better and removes the sickness. So it is with folly. So it is with unbelief. Now, and this must be done to us truly here, right? Now we need the antibodies that come from outside. We need Christ. And now we've moved from secular to vertical to our relationship with God and salvation very quickly here, because it has much application. Because clearly, the unbeliever seeks salvation in vain. They seek the wisdom of spirituality, but not religion, in vain. They seek it in their own vanity, in themselves, which is what always comes back to when you, if you listen carefully to it, you can hear it too. Even the best of them that are talking about love, 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 it always comes back to me, me, me at the end, even if it's in a very loving sounding way. But knowledge is easy for a man of understanding. So, one who knows that to have understanding, I must learn, I must know what I do not know, I must acknowledge that the folly in me is something that must be purged from me, from those who are wiser than I, that man can actually learn something. And this goes for everything from how to read all the way up to the very top, to who is Jesus and what has he done. And once you have that knowledge that you don't know what you don't know, now your heart is open to understand, to fathom, to grasp, to have it all filled up and poured into. And doubly so, then, the beauty of Christianity is that there is no mystery in this. And don't get me wrong, the Trinity is a mystery. Lord's Supper is a mystery, but what I mean is no hidden thing, no dark secret corner that you have to be really smart or an insider to really get. There are things God has not revealed to us, but all that he has revealed, even a child can learn and understand. Sometimes even better than we can, because children are more willing to take things on faith than we are. They'll believe a declaration far quicker than we will, who want to wrap our brains around it. Even so, for the man who has the true knowledge of God, the spirit-driven faith which believes in the resurrection of Jesus, trusts that the Holy Scriptures are indeed inspired and inerrant, this knowledge comes easy, even the knowledge that I do not know. Even the limitation of my mind becomes something that is no longer, well, fighting against my vanity in the same way. My vanity is free to die. That freedom is a wonderful knowledge in and of itself. You're listening to His Time, your morning drive for the soul on Worldwide KFUO. We'll be back in just a minute to do a little more digging, a little more meditation, meditatio, with some loud music on John chapter 18, verses 15 through 40. Stick around.